Hey, this is Brian Zond, and I'm glad that you're interested in the podcast. You know, it's a free podcast, and it'll always be that way. But if you would like to give and help us out, that would be awesome, deeply appreciated. If you want to do that, you can do that through the Word of Life website or through the Word of Life mobile app. Anyway, God bless you. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Last Friday, while I was preaching on Jacob wrestling with the angel at Jabbok, I mentioned some of what I consider the most important stories in the Old Testament. These are stories that seem to have deep spiritual mysteries embedded in them. Well, one of those stories is Moses at the burning bush. There is so much in this story. I just read the first part. I just read the first part of the story. We're going to look at the second part next Friday. It's going to take two Fridays to look at this. The second part of the story is where God discloses his divine name to Moses. The tetragrammaton, I am who I am. That's next Friday. Tonight, I want to look at the first part of the story, and I'll call this sermon Holy Ground. Moses was born during the greatest time of the Israelites' suffering in Egypt. They had become enslaved. They were a minority population who were forced labor for the dominant, privileged majority. And they were suffering terribly. And in fact, at one point, a royal decree comes from Pharaoh that male babies are to be exterminated. Well, through a series of providential circumstances, Moses survives that Holocaust. And in a very strange twist in the story, Moses ends up, he's an Israelite, you know, from the tribe of Levi, but he ends up being raised as an Egyptian in Pharaoh's own household. But then, midway through life, about the age of 40, Moses began to discover his true self. Very often that's the way it is. Sometimes happens around about that age, give or take a decade. People begin to maybe, possibly, discover who they really are. Moses ends up, after this crisis of identity, Moses ends up in the desert wilderness tending flocks for his father-in-law. Now, one way of looking at this point of the story is that Moses has become what the world would call a failure. He had been a prominent figure of political power and wealth in the household of Pharaoh, but in discovering his true identity, it results in a kind of what people would call a failure. I mean, after all, he's gone from being a prominent figure in the courts of Pharaoh, the most powerful man leading the most powerful empire in the world, to being a goat herder out in the desert, and they're not even his goats. He's working for his father-in-law, not just in the desert, but as King James calls it, the backside of the desert. Moses is taking care of the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, at the foot of Mount Sinai, or Horeb. They're the same mountain, Horeb, Sinai, same mountain. And it's a very mysterious place. Perry and I went there about 10 years ago, a little more. And it really is a strange, exotic, mysterious place. It's difficult to get to. There are no major roads, hardly any roads at all. But you can get there if you try hard enough. Desert wildernesses have long been places associated with deep spirituality. There is a monastery there at this place that we visited, out in the middle of the Sinai Desert, at the foot of Mount Sinai. St. Catherine's Monastery, Greek Orthodox monks are there. And it happens to be the site of the longest continual Christian worship in history. For 17 centuries, these people have been praying five times a day. That itself just moves me. That prayer five times a day has been going on in this one place for 17 centuries. Desert places. Waste. I read a book maybe a year and a half ago, The Solace of Fierce Landscapes, Exploring Desert and Mountain Spirituality. It's by a guy named Belden Lane. Very excellent book. Well, what is it about the deserts and the mountains that draw mystics and monks, and here in our story, Moses? I think it has to do with the fact that they are quiet and uncluttered places. Of course, I mean that they are uncluttered from the ordinary noise and chatter and distractions of life. They are places of quiet and solitude. But I'm also actually referring to the landscape itself. Broad and open vistas are they're good for the soul. Sometimes we're too crowded. Sometimes everything's closing in on us. And there's something about being, whether it's the desert, or for me it's more often the high tundra, the Rocky Mountains, when you get up out of the forest and all the way up on those high tundras where everything's very expansive. And whether you can understand it or not, I'll still say it, I feel my own soul begin to expand. And I breathe deeper, and I think deeper, and I pray better. I do my best thinking about God and praying to God in the high tundra. I just can't be petty up there. The idea of a small, capricious, petty God just seems laughable when I can get into a wide open expanse. My theology becomes more generous. It's not cramped, it's not pinched, it's not small, it's not petty. So Moses is in that kind of place. And he's about to have a mystical experience. I use the word mystic and mystical a lot. I think I need to make sure you understand what I mean, how I use those words. I use those words in the most technical sense. A mystic is simply someone who has a direct experience with God. So a mystical experience is an unmediated, direct encounter with the divine. That's all I mean. That's all that's truly meant by that word mystic or mystical. It's a direct encounter with the divine. The great theologian Karl Rahner said back in the 1970s, the Christian of the future will be a mystic or nothing at all. I agree with that. Well, here we are with middle-aged Moses, a failure, as it were, living a quiet life in a contemplative place. And suddenly Moses has a mystical experience, and it's one of the great turning points in the Bible. You know, God always has partners for his purposes. God doesn't do what he wants to do. God does what he can do, because he has to find people to cooperate with him. God's patient. He might have to wait a century or 1,000 years or maybe longer. But he waits until he can find an Abraham or a Moses to cooperate with him. And so there's Moses, a man who had been at the top of society, but in discovering his true identity, he's become a, quote, failure. He takes care of his father-in-law's goats. But he's in a place that is mysterious. A place that is evocative. A place that lends itself to the contemplative. He's in complete solitude. There's no one else around. And he comes upon a bush that is burning. That's strange enough. Just to be out there all by yourself, you know there's no one around, and suddenly you find a bush that's on fire. But stranger yet, the bush, though on fire, is not being burned up. It's not turning black and then turning to ashes. It's as if fire is in the bush, but the bush itself is unharmed by the fire. This indeed is a strange and mysterious sight. So Moses turns aside to contemplate this wonder. That's something important right there. Very important. Moses turns aside and gives place to wonder. And it's then that he encounters the divine. All that Moses becomes famous for, the Exodus, the Ten Commandments, leading Israel through the wilderness, all of that comes about as a result of this single mystical encounter at the burning bush. The point of the burning bush is that the glory of God was in the bush. Now, when Perry and I were at St. Catherine's Monastery in 2006, the monks showed us a bush. It was a very, very large green bush, kind of in the center of the monastery, there in the courtyard. And they said, that's the burning bush. You know, I'm a bit skeptical. Modern empiricist that I am. But then I think, why not? Who am I to say it's not? They've been there 17 centuries. Maybe they know what they're talking about. Okay, I'll just take your word. Now you may think, I wish I could see that bush. Or you may think, I wish I could see a bush like that. I mean, I wish I could see a bush on fire with God. Well, you can. You can, because you see, every bush is on fire with the glory of God. That's not hyperbole. That's the truth. Every bush is on fire with the glory of God. You see, the deeper truth is that the real miracle wasn't that the bush was burning with the glory of God, but that Moses had reached a place where he could turn aside and perceive it. That's the thing about us. We rarely turn aside. We never turn aside. We turn neither to the right nor to the left. We just barrel on down the highway. We're in a rush. We're in a hurry. We've got things to do, appointments to keep. Always on the move. Fast, 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 fast. Can't ever turn aside. This is Egypt, where they're busy all the time making their bricks and building their pyramids and whatever else they're doing. This is America. This is modernity. So if you want to find a burning bush, you're going to have to find a Sinai, a wilderness, a park, a quiet place. You can find them. It's not that hard, actually. Just turn aside a little bit. You can find them. They're all around you. For Perry and I, walking the Camino was 40 days of quiet and uncluttered living in search of burning bushes. You know, people are still asking me. I did a podcast lots of podcasts about people that walk the Camino, and so I did that. And they always ask you, well, what did you learn? And I don't know. We finished about 15 weeks ago, and I think I'm just beginning to absorb some of the lessons. I think if you ask too soon, you're not sure what you've learned. You know you've learned something, but you don't know what it is. It's been almost 4 months now. And here's what, I mean, I've already told you this. Walking the Camino, this 500-mile walk from Saint-Jean-Pierre de Port-au-Prince to Santiago de Compostela, Spain, is very clearly a metaphor for life. And you're aware of this. But here's the thing about your life. You can't get perspective on it because you're stuck in the middle of living it. So you don't have a perspective of it. The Camino, though, is a miniature lifetime. Just trust me on this. Everybody that walks it senses that. And so instead of 80 years, it's 6 weeks. And then you can step back and look at it. You can gain some perspective on it. And here's the lesson I learned, and I mean this deeply. Don't be in a hurry. I'm talking about the Camino, but I'm talking about life. I'm talking about both at the same time, so stick with me. Don't be in a hurry. Don't rush. It will be over soon enough. Now, if you're going to go walk the Camino, somebody asked me some questions today. They're thinking about doing that. So I told them these things. But I'm talking to you about your life. Don't rush. Don't be in a hurry. It'll be over soon enough. Stay open to beauty. It's all around you. But if you never turn aside, if you never slow down, if you never pay attention, if you're never present in the moment, you just rush past. See, this is the deep regret I have. Overall, I think I did okay. Perry did way better than I did. I mean, she just honestly did. But the regrets I have about my walk of the Camino, they're the same regrets I have about, it reflects back on me, on my life. This is how I live my life. And so the Spirit says to me, Brian, the mistakes that you made on the Camino, learn from them so you don't make them in life, because that's really what matters. And the biggest mistake I made was too often getting in too much of a hurry. Get a stage done. Let's get to the next destination. Why? Let's hurry up and finish it. Why? Because when it's over, it's over. What are you in such a hurry for? Soak it in. Now, sometimes I did. In fact, a lot of the time I did. But the moments I regret were the times that somehow I lost that sense and I'm not turning aside, I'm rushing. Here's one moment I wasn't rushing. Here's a picture. I took this picture, this is probably during the last week. It's in Galicia. And I just stopped because I felt something in that moment. It was in the morning. And I took that picture. I want you to look at that. And I want you to know that everything you see in that picture is burning with the glory of God. That tree right there, it's aflame with the glory of God. that pasture, those mountains in the distance, all on fire with the glory of God. Even that stone wall, that wooden gate, that path, and that pilgrim up ahead, burning with the glory of God. But you have to turn aside to see it. So what's the first thing that Moses learns in his burning bush encounter? Well, the first thing he learns is that he's standing on holy ground. And so he is. It's still holy today. That's why St. Catherine's Monastery has been there for 17 centuries. There are sacred places. Thin places, the Celtic Christians called them. Places where it's apparent that the membrane between heaven and earth is worn quite thin. Holy sites. Holy land. Perry and I are going to take our 15th, lead our 15th tour of Israel this November. I don't have the dates Perry does, and we'll get you information on that in the next week or so. But because we believe in Jesus, Bethlehem is holy. So on this tour, we're going to spend some more time there. Maybe even a night or maybe two nights. Nazareth is holy. Capernaum is holy. The Sea of Galilee is holy. Jerusalem is holy. We need holy places to help cultivate our sense of the sacred. I'm going to take 3 days next week and go off to Conception Abbey on a spiritual silence retreat. See, we've reached the point where, you know, Perry's, for my birthday, she sends me off to a monastery for a silence retreat. That's really how that works, basically. But it's a good thing. Our upper room is a holy place. Can't you sense that? It's not like any place else in the building. Isn't there something different about that room? You know that. That's why I only want to do my prayer schools in there. By spending time in places connected with sacred history or places set aside for sacred worship, we develop a capacity to see the glory of God in every bush. This is holy ground. Of course, the deeper truth is that every step we take is on holy ground. It's all holy. It's all holy. Eric has already mentioned Wendell Berry. I think it was Wendell Berry that taught us there are no sacred places. There are no non-sacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. There are no non-sacred places. Only sacred places and, unfortunately, sometimes desecrated places. But it's specific holy places that lead us to the way of seeing all places as holy. I think it takes what we call holy places. Somebody can say, well, they're all holy. Okay, I'm with you. I agree, but I think if you just jump there too quick, it's cheap. And it's just something you've learned to say. It's kind of a retort. It's actually, in some ways, kind of a cooperation with secularism. I think for us to really develop that sense where that all places are truly sacred, it actually begins by recognizing certain places as sacred. So if you ask me, do we need sacred spaces and holy sites? I say, oh yes, absolutely, and perhaps now more than ever. Now the voice from the burning bush tells Moses to treat the holy ground as holy. Take off your shoes. The ground upon which you stand is holy. Removing shoes is an ancient practice of reverence for holy places. So I've been around the world. I've been to Rome and Paris and Dubai even. But in my travels around the world, I visited many, many holy places. And in many of them, part of the requirement for entering was to remove your shoes. So I've visited mosques where I took off my shoes. And Buddhist temples where I've taken off my shoes. Hindu temples where I've taken off my shoes. Some churches in India observe this practice. The very first time I went to India, way back, I think it was 1991. The first meeting, I just got there. The first meeting I had was a church in a little town called Kurukshetra. It's very famous in Hindu legend, the city is. And so I did what everybody did. I took off my shoes. There's a pile of shoes, just a whole collection of shoes outside the church door. And we went in and we had our service and I preached. And a couple of hours later, I come back and I can't find my shoes. And pretty soon, all the shoes are gone. And my shoes just aren't there. And the pastor said to me, "Oh, yeah, sometimes the Hindus, they are coming and stealing our shoes." And so I left in my socks, walking the streets of Kurukshetra back to my hotel. Next morning, had to go find a shoe store. This isn't a big city. Found a shoe store, and the only thing in my size were like, they look just like bowling shoes, okay? So for about a week until I could get to New Delhi, I was in bowling shoes. True story. But these are places that have a sense of the holy. And so you take off your shoes. The only place in America where they ask me to take off my shoes is TSA. And they also get me to lift my hands, too. Because in a secular society, only security is sacred. Ow! I could preach that. Well, there is another place where we remove our shoes. There is another place where we remove our shoes. Home. Home. And it too is holy. It's the place where we can most easily be our true selves. There's a mystery in this. The mystery of how we come to be at home with the holy. When we first encounter the holy, we take off our shoes because of the fear of God. And it's the beginning of wisdom, but it's not the end. Eventually, we learn to take off our shoes because we're at home with the holy. Holy ground. Where every bush, every leaf, every grain of sand is on fire with the glory of God. Burning because it's on fire with God. That's our true home. That's where we're to live. Holy ground is where we were meant to live. In fact, it's where we do live. But it takes a long time to cultivate this kind of awareness, a lot of turning aside, which is part of what contemplative prayer is about. So it takes the practices of prayer and contemplation and maybe pilgrimage and visit the sacred spaces to help alert us to the fact that we live our lives on holy ground. Holy ground is our home. It's the place where we can take off our shoes. Amen. Amen. And tonight we come to a holy place.